Welcome to the Best Science Medicine Podcast, BS without the BS.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the 567th episode of the Best Science Medicine Podcast. My name is James McCormack, and I'm a professor with the Faculty of Pharmaceutical Sciences at the University of British Columbia.
I'm Mike Allen. I'm a family doctor and the director of practice support at the College of Family Physicians of Canada. I'm also an adjunct professor at the University of Alberta.
And Mike, you just came back from an industry-funded vacation. Is that correct?
I just came back from a 16-day cruise.
Yes.
Sponsored by... No, I haven't done that, James. But it turns out that that thing, that historically was not that uncommon. Some of that stuff has toned down a bit. And we'll talk about that as we go on, why that is. It turns out it's not due to a higher moral rising of...
No.
Physicians and other healthcare providers. It actually is the industry policing itself, or setting up policies, at least,
yeah,
to police itself.
And this is a, if you're trying to figure out what we're going to talk about, and the title is, your title, Mike, is Industry and Us. Like, how do we interact? Because it's unavoidable that there's an interaction with industry. And the issue is how do you deal with it? How to think about it? And here's the caveat. I literally did go on an all-paid expenses event probably in 1987, went to Paradise Island.
So that recent?
That recent, yes. That was just last Tuesday. I'm not a complete virgin on this, but I have not accepted any money from the drug industry in about almost 40 years now. But that's sort of where I stand. And I'm sure you may have had some similar things back earlier on. But
so back in 1998, I had a drug dinner.
Yes, there you go.
That I went to. And I raised some issues. And at the end of that, I realized, this was way before I became an academic, but I just realized, like, these aren't the places for me.
Yeah, no, I agree. Yeah.
I pick and it makes everyone uncomfortable. And yeah, so I decided that I just wouldn't go. And it wasn't for... Like, there was always talk at your university training that, beware of industry. But it was more that if I'm going to try and nitpick the studies and things like that, then I probably shouldn't even be going.
Yeah, no, exactly. And we'll talk about that as we get through it. But why don't you sort of start us off?
Yeah. So one of the biggest things about it, and we've talked about this before on the podcast, mm-hmm. but it was a decade ago, mm-hmm. or so. Mm-hmm. And, we can also just, what is the right amount of time before industry interactions like yours and mine, James, become less relevant? And it's interesting that the cutoff, before we get into the main podcast, is often 2 to 3 years. Now,
yeah.
I think most people would say that by 40, the influence has evaporated.
Am I okay? Yeah, I'm okay with that. But you're right, it is. But it does vary.
Yes, it varies. So, and 2 to 3 is often the kind of standard if you've taken money for a drug talk or something like that. Like how long you still have to continue to report it.
Yeah.
So,
it also gets very tricky because it is possible that you haven't taken any money in the last 5 years, but you will be giving a talk in a month. Then when
And that's happened before as part of Tools for Practice and other work that mm-hmm. you and I do. We've had co-authors. I don't know if it's happened to you, James. Yeah. I assume it has. Where you've had a co-author agree to be a co-author. You check their conflicts. They were all fine. And then by the time the darn thing's published, their conflicts have changed.
Yeah, no, exactly. And we saw it all when I was the associate chair of the Clinical Research Ethics Board. It was so tricky. And then not only is it tricky to figure out the time frame, but then who do you tell? When is it an issue? And we are not naive to think that the only influence in the world is from industry.
That's there's so many pieces to this. And my lens to look at, and then we also ask people, do you, report things that you think are relevant?
Mm-hmm.
Well, what I think is relevant might be different than you. And even if I sit on a guideline panel, one of the approaches to influence is to report your influence, and then the panel judges whether you can continue to be a voting member for that piece.
Yeah.
And that, of course, would have so many elements that would influence. Like, do you like the guy? Or this person? Do you like them or not? And all of that would even I suspect even more than the degree of industry.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. I would not actually rank the influence of industry and gifts from industry as the major driver of beliefs, in my opinion.
Yeah. I would go as far as to say that where you are academically and your kind of predisposition, people call it confirmation bias, It's called all sorts of things. But once you kind of get an opinion, that opinion becomes virtually impenetrable to facts.
Yeah.
so that, you know, we'll talk about industry and It's an important element. It absolutely is. But there are multiple influences on it.
No, exactly.
So let's talk a little bit about it. Let's talk first about gifts, because gifts are one of these things that, and gifts can come in all sorts of shapes and sizes. And in studies, they do. So they come as just straight up money. Mm-hmm. They come as a trip somewhere, a dinner. They come up as pens. Some even include office samples as gifts. So know that when we talk about research for gifts, we're talking about a massive collection of different definition of what would be included as a gift. That's important to understand. And sometimes a gift is not, other people would argue a gift comes when you're not expecting something in reciprocal. Mm-hmm. And so they would say that if you're doing a talk, even if it's for $10,000 for a 1-hour talk, that's not a gift because you're actually paying them to do something.
Right.
So that's the point. So there's nuances, but let's kind of get into the logic behind gifts and the process that goes on in our minds. So first thing is that most of us would say to ourselves, well, I would only take a gift if it didn't influence my prescribing. And that's the key here in healthcare, because if I market to you, James, you're coming in to look for a car, and I market to you and get you to buy a car that maybe actually you don't need from what you said, that's you who's made the decision. James McCormick has made the decision to buy a more expensive car. The difference is...
Well, and I would use the industry money I get to do that, to pay for it.
Thank you for that. And I don't think any of our listeners had any doubt.
No.
but in the healthcare industry, I'm being marketed to, and the people who suffer the cost, the increased cost of the drugs and the potential side effects and all of those things, is actually someone else. Mm-hmm. So that's why there's a little bit more of, I think, a magnifying glass on this kind of interaction. No one's judging too much if we get convinced to buy a new fast food today because we saw some advertisement or heard something on.
Mm-hmm. No, exactly.
But the difference is in the healthcare pharmaceutical industry, we're talking about changing things for other people, and we're potentially getting the benefit.
Yeah, no, exactly.
Dinner or the trip. So we, one of the things that we have to do cognitively is believe that we are not going to be influenced, because if we did, most of us would then, if we accepted that we were being influenced, we would feel bad and be less likely to take a gift.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No.
So go ahead.
No, I was going to say, a lot of people go, well, I might believe they're not influenced, but I don't know whether it be, whether I should be using the word obvious or subtle in this next sentence, but if you didn't go to these, you may not have ever heard of that drug in the first place. So it's one of the most important things is just getting the name of the drug into the essence of your being. And that is an impossible thing to not be influenced, unless you have no memory.
Well, so interesting you bring that up, and we don't have this on our list of speaking points today, but there was a study done years ago that I thought was absolutely brilliant. And they talked to docs, they had a pharmaceutical rep visit, and they talked to them about the drug. And then they quizzed the doctors a little while later about the drug, and most of them couldn't recall the name of the drug. Mm-hmm. But when they looked at their prescribing behavior, it actually changed in favor. So they couldn't remember what pharmaceutical rep, you know, John Smith talked to them about, but they did change their prescribing based on that.
Yeah. Now, so part of it was they may have been embarrassed because they couldn't pronounce it, but that's a different story.
those things, as everyone who listens knows, happens to us all the time. So these are an important step in kind of convincing healthcare providers that they can't, or they're not being influenced, or they can't be influenced. You have to kind of foster that belief, and you'll hear the kind of rub, as they say, the statement that, well, you're too smart to be fooled by marketing.
Yeah.
Like, those kind of terms are used all the time to reassure us that we're somehow immune to marketing strategies, whatever those marketing strategies.
And that's such an incredible, that's such an assumption, because it assumes that you are familiar with all of these strategies, that you actually understand statistics, and it goes on and on and on and on.
Oh, there's, to know, I remember one of the first things when I graduated was being involved in a survey, it turned out to be a marketing thing for a bladder drug, an interstitial cystitis drug. And I didn't know until I was at the second stage that I was actually, the survey was just a piece to draw me in to get me to do interviews with reps. And then that they could kind of figure out, okay, what things is he likely to ask that I will be able to reassure him or her about. So like in this case, you might say something like, but I heard this side effect happens. Like, let's say you were marketing bupropion and I might say to you, but what about the risk of seizure with bupropion? You would then be trained to take a deep breath, sigh, kind of nod in approving, like you understand, and then say, have you seen it? Because of course we hadn't, right? Wouldn't, it'd be so unlikely. And then the answer then is, so you're not seeing it very often, are you?
Yeah.
And that kind of, like, it's all strategized well ahead, that rep visit.
No, and a strategy is also, you know, when I did see drug reps, which I did, because I found it fascinating, they know that when they are taught how to deal with someone like me, who will, you know, argue most points or say, well, what about this? And they will cajole you and say, they'll go to your sense of feeling good about yourself by saying, we know that you always take apart the clinical trials, and you know, and it's really, and they're saying it in a way that engages you to go, they know that I'm smart, which I'm not saying I am, but you know what I mean?
That is a big part of it. You're too smart. All of that. And then ask you questions that you probably don't know the answer to. Like, have you heard of this trial name, small trial, like whatever. And you're like, oh no, I actually, now I feel dumb. And then they build you up. It's all a cycle. It's very brilliant.
Yeah,
but let's get on to, so what did this study show about this? This was in the BMJ Open in 2017. And this was a review of 49 studies. And what they found was that most studies that have looked at this show that doctors don't believe that gifts or interactions influence them. And some believe that interactions may be influential, but if it is, it's more likely to others than to themselves. And there's a belief that the more gifts, or there's a finding that the more gifts that you've taken, the stronger your belief that you're not influenced by gifts.
Which is,
you know, it's the perfect immunization. You give someone a gift, they have to believe that that's not influencing them for ethical reasons. And they've already taken one. So, well, I've taken one and I wasn't influenced, so now I can take another. And you know what I mean? Like, it's a cycle that feeds on itself. And one of the studies, of course, quoted in there was from the American Journal of Medicine in 2001. And it's one of my personal favorites. And it asks doctors, do you think gifts influence you? And 61% of them said, no, it doesn't. So, you know, over half. And then they said, do you think that gifts influence others? 84% said yes.
And those, they really can't, those two statistics cannot stand against each other.
No, they fail all logic.
Yes. Yeah.
Right. Like it's kind of the Dunning-Kruger thing. How can everyone be a better than average driver?
Yeah, no, exactly. Yeah.
So it's just this, and it's all part of the psychology of how these things have to work.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So I think that's so important for us to understand going in, and probably one of the kind of watershed turning point moments in the thinking about how gifts might influence us was a paper by Wazana, and that was in JAMA 2000. So we're going way back, because mm-hmm. I started with more recent, but I wanted to kind of put some foundation on why, like what happened that kind of turned the corner? And we always knew that interactions with industry of any type would obviously, the goal of the industry is to influence us. So, but the difference was that Wazana kind of took all the different studies in the systematic review and then did the Bradford Hill kind of rules of causation. And listeners will know we've used that term. Mm-hmm. That's when you look at observational studies and hold them against some standards to try and say, could this actually be causation? Mm-hmm. Because the only thing that can even come close to proving causation is an RCT. So these things are, or at least more easily. Mm-hmm. So observational studies, they have to kind of meet criteria to reassure you that there is causation. And these are things like, is it consistent? Is the strength of the findings large enough, like 2 times, like mm-hmm. a relative is 2 times? Is it dose related? Is there a temporal relationship so that once you start the drug or start the intervention, other things happen after it? So all of those things kind of have to fall into place. And what Wazana found is that most things had that kind of met the Bradford Hill or rules of causation criteria. And you probably know that study, James. That would be that you would have read for sure.
Because of my age is what you're saying.
Yeah, because you're, I don't want to use the word elderly. Let's say mature.
I wouldn't. I certainly wouldn't use the word mature. But.
You're still looking for that.
Still childlike, just not childish. But like you say, there's so many different, and they looked at so many different categories, right? Like, you know, the interaction with reps and gifts and all sorts of different things.
Yeah, yeah. Honorariums, do they influence us?
Yeah,
all sorts of things.
Samples and meals and all that sort of stuff. But the one at the bottom of that, and it's an intriguing one to know where to put this one, and it's called research funding. And, you know, research funding is a vague term. And one of the things that I've always struggled with is that, you know, it for research to get done, if it's a new drug, it's going to have to be funded by the industry, in my opinion. I don't think the public should fund it. And then if you do that, I don't think it's reasonable that you should try to find people to do it for free. So, you know, there are pharmaceutical grants for research and there's fees for participating in clinical trials and all that sort of stuff. And that drug company money is often what is reported when you hear clinicians and researchers get money. I think that is subtly different than what we're talking about, because I think even though it's probably influential as well, but it's unavoidable. It may be that they actually don't necessarily get that money. It goes to do the work. So it also allows them to hire people to do other research as well. So it's very tricky.
Yeah, no, this is a hard area of research. And there's a book called The Truth About Drug Industry by, mm-hmm. I think her name's Marcy Angel. I might be getting it wrong. She's from the New England Journal. She was the editor of the New England Journal. Yeah. She wrote it. It's a good book.
Mm-hmm.
Now she takes a very strong stance against industry, but it's still a good book. And in it, she talks about that very thing, James. And then, mm-hmm. often industry joins in a lot of the initial research on drug development comes at a kind of university level where it's researchers sometimes working on public funding, sometimes working on funding from industry, but often a mix. And they're just very much at the kind of, and it takes hundreds of chemicals to get to something that looks promising.
Right.
And at that point, industry steps in and really, like you say, would it be reasonable to take millions of dollars of public money to see if a drug even has a chance of working when most of them don't. So I agree with you that it really has to be something like industry, but often they're not taking it from the idea of a chemical.
Oh, no, absolutely. Yeah, no, it's a game.
Yeah. And they're partly out of they're out of the barn and they're on their way, but to looking somewhat promising. And that's when industry joins in. And you're right. The money doesn't. So the industry funded trial, the money doesn't pour into the lead author's pockets.
No.
He or she might get money, but they're not. What's happening a lot is they're paying. So for recruitment of people in clinical trials, the clinicians who recruit patients to join the clinical trials often get research funding too.
Yeah.
Get money to compensate for their time. And often it's enough money that some of them will actually redirect that money to be used for research. There's many, won't say who, but there's university departments and programs that recruit for clinical trials. It's a bunch of doctors and clinicians who've gotten together. They pool that money and then do their own studies off they make from those recruitment studies. So they're not, some of them are not even pocketing the money. They're just using it to further.
Yeah. I was just going to say, so when you hear X person got $1 million from this industry, there is so much digging you got to figure out to what that really means. Now,
there is some studies that show that if I took money, even for research, that the way I write for up.
Oh, yeah. Still influences.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
For
sure. Oh, no. Yeah. But it's not as if, you know, you were given $1 million and then you went and bought a plane with it. It's different.
Yeah, or took a trip to South America with it.
Yes.
Yeah. No, they don't quite have that. So there's a bunch of studies too that have looked at this. One published in PLOS One in 2017. It looked at 19 different studies of contact with industry. 12 were ret visits. They all found that ret visits were associated with changes in prescribing, other things like GIFs and CME all found that, not all, they didn't all find it consistently, but most found an association with changes in prescribing due to GIFs and CME events and all sorts of stuff.
Like that. But I think it's also important to point out that when we're talking about prescribing changes, we're not suggesting that, you know, all of a sudden you go from 0 to 100 in what?
Oh no, it's
very subtle, right?
Because influences are smaller than you might think, and not as easily proved. So And these are being written by people who are, these systematic reviews and some of the studies are being written by people who also have a bias against industry. Now, like everything, there's no people without biases one way or the other. But they're likely to have an influence on the way they write, the way they analyze, et cetera. And they're not finding, like you say, that they went from not prescribing this drug to only prescribing this drug. The differences are smaller.
And like I said, even like I know people who do, you know, sort of the opposite of, you know, they do academic detailing and they would be thrilled. And I've seen this with some of the education work we've done. We would be thrilled if we could, you know, shift 5% of prescribing.
Yeah.
That also makes it shows why it's so tricky because most people are not going to be terribly influenced, but it's subtle enough that if you put in, you know, even if you put $500,000 into education and marketing, changing, you know, people 5% if there's a lot of people you changed, you can get that money back in spades.
Yeah, for sure. Because you can, and then there's certain people who you can influence that will have the larger scale influence. So you might pick to influence a prominent cardiologist in a community because that cardiologist touches and is trusted by all the family doctors who refer to him or her, right?
Yeah.
So let's talk about another one. This was from PLOS Medicine in 2010. It was 58 studies with 87 analyses. And what they found was that pharmaceutical interaction led to changes in quality of care. That was studied in 10 of them. In five cases, in five of the studies, it led to worse quality. And four, it had no effect, and one, it had mixed results. So that's kind of speaking to what you were saying, James. Mm-hmm. Like, they're not. It's not a slam dunk.
No.
That if industry gets involved, you know, healthcare goes to garbage. It's not like
not at all.
You care. You know, it did get worse in about half of them, but in others, it wasn't consistent.
Yeah, and you know, I kind of wish it did, because then there'd be a big uproar.
Yeah, and you could sort it out.
Yeah, easily. Now we do. There are things in place to you know, reduce this, and that's been going on for decades, and I think it's always very tricky. But yeah, no, it's important to realize that, you know, it's basically these are all sort of, they're trying to influence / educate,
educate / influence
Sure.
So let's talk a little bit about some of the other things, like the frequency of prescribing. So that was studied in 51 studies, 38 found an increase in prescribing and 13 found no effect. Looking at pharmaceutical rep visits, there were 28 studies that did that. 17 showed increased prescribing, 6 showed mixed results, and 5 no effect. What about attendance of at a conference or a meeting? 5 found it was associated, 3 found no effect. Journal advertisements. They're the trickiest ones for me. I don't know about you, James, but I have not been impressed that journal advertisements have big effects on prescribing. Just like you said, interactions, it's hard sometimes to show an effect. In this case,
it's almost like it's a glance.
Yeah,
I like them because I think they're clever, and they're fun to watch, and they're sometimes funny, but. Yeah, it is, but a single journal advert, again, it's a multi-pronged approach.
Yeah, they generally were not. They were four had no statistical testing at all, and there was, they kind of suggest in the article that there was an effect, but it wasn't as solid as the other ones. And then costs. So 5 out of them showed an increased cost. 4 showed no change, and 1 actually showed lower cost.
Mm-hmm.
So. Yeah, it's just
wouldn't be unusual to say, you know, I guess you could show lower cost if the company that was going in to market to you had a lower price product.
Yeah.
You know, that doesn't mean it wasn't influenced. That is all I'm saying.
Yeah, yeah. No, you could still be influenced. Yeah. This one looked at, this was a JAMA article from JAMA Internal Medicine from 2016, and it took about 280,000 docs, and it reviewed them to see claims for going out for meals and stuff. And 63,000 out of that 280 had got a meal-related teaching event for one of 4 drugs. What surprised me here was the price of the meals. Mm-hmm. They were $12 to $18 in the U.S.
Yeah.
Now, in my experience, a lot of the drug dinners are way more expensive. So these are, what's this telling us, that they're lunch meals?
Yeah, no, exactly. They're bringing, and this is not to cast aspersion on any company, but Subway sandwiches.
They're bringing that kind of thing. Yeah. Maybe a little bit like one of the classier sandwich joints. They're bringing that in for the clinic, right? And
No, so exactly. Because from experience, the meals I have attended, again, 40 years ago, were a little more expensive than that.
It's just showing that the average one, and you think about all of the lunches that are paid for in rounds at hospitals and stuff, and they're usually sandwich trays.
Yeah, no, and here's what I've always said about this. You know, if I can get the attention of a doctor or any healthcare provider for $12. I mean, I can't get anyone to do anything for $10 an hour.
No, and it's amazing how, there's some great books on this. his name sounds like a friend of ours, Adil Varani. So I can't remember. It's Old Annie, I think is his last name, this author. But he writes about having been a pharmaceutical rep, and then he became a PhD candidate. He writes a great book. I just remember the name of it, but Old Annie was his last name. And he says, you don't even need to talk about product. You just need to kind of, you just need to let them know what your drug is and then give them a good time.
Yeah, no, exactly.
It's pretty interesting. But anyhow, so studies, and then this was done of studies of payments to physicians. And what it found was that the more the payments that you had, the higher the ratio of increasing your the amount that would change your prescribing. So if you got, you know, if you got four sponsored meals versus one, at one sponsored meal, the hazard ratio for increased prescribing was 1.18. But if you got four or more meals, it was 1.34. And what that's showing us is there's a dose response relationship. And that is another rules of causation thing. So it's just, and that study was published in the Annals of Internal Medicine just a couple of years ago in 2021. But it's just showing that there were 36 studies, and out of them, 30 were positive, 6 were mixed, and none of them were null. The most common way that people were being gifted was meals. And they found a dose response relationship in many, and they found that there was also temporal relationships. So one of the things that comes up when we talk about this is, you know, what do patients perceive of us? And the what's interesting to me is there's a feeling that patients are really very upset or would be very upset. And I've always been impressed by the fact that they're actually not as worried about it as some of us think. There certainly are groups that are worried about it or concerned, but they're not as upset as we might think. So, for example, this was a study published in PLOS One in 2016, and it was a systematic review of 20 studies. And they asked first, do you even know about some of them? And about, depending on the study, 40 to 83% knew that doctors got some gifts. They knew that it could be a half to three quarters knew that it was like a pen or something like that. 30% knew that they could get personal gifts. And a quarter to one third knew that it could involve dinners. And anywhere from a quarter to two thirds thought it could increase the cost of healthcare. And that it could influence, a quarter to three quarters thought it could influence quality of care. Now, here's the thing. So then they asked them about appropriateness, not always the same study, but this is what I find fascinating. So, is it appropriate for a drug company to pay for lunch, including lunch for staff? 66 to 83% of patients thought that was reasonable.
Yeah.
And that surprised me.
Yeah. No. I think as you started off with this particular topic, you're right. There are people who research this. There are some people who are very, and I'm going to use the word anti-industry, even though they may not be anti-industry, but they're always looking to find out if this is the thing that is being influenced. And I think in general, I think the perception is that I trust my healthcare provider to not necessarily be influenced, but the studies suggest they still think it does, but they don't care.
The patients don't care as much.
Yeah.
So that's, I think, what's so important here to understand. Now, do they not care at all? No.
Of course they do. Yeah.
More of them will feel. So about 12 to 35% will feel that it's okay to take doctors out to dinner. But about 50% will say, no, that's not okay.
Yeah.
So it's not like it's a blank check.
No.
Pardon the analogy.
Yeah, exactly.
but it's... patients have more comfort with this than we might believe. So for example, is it reasonable to give samples? 70% to 90% think that's reasonable.
Mm-hmm. And it depends how you even define reasonable, right? Because I think, you know, I think you can make an argument for some samples in some settings and so on. The problem is that you never have samples, or almost never is a bit of a stretch, almost never have samples of drugs that you would want to use.
So the way samples, I've seen the literature on this before, and it could have changed in the last 5 years or so, but my summary of the literature before was, in most cases, samples actually lead to increased cross-prescribing. Mm-hmm. No shock to you or I.
No.
But in places where, and it's interesting because these were, they examined them where people did not have access to certain drugs easily. In those cases, so in other words, it was a socioeconomic status issue. In those cases, samples could actually be helpful because docs would basically provide all that the patient needed from their sample covered for the year. So in those cases, there was some evidence that it may be helpful, but the overall trend was to just increase costs. So, but patients are clearly less worried about that than us, even though they recognize that these things could be increasing costs. So other things that you might think of, the common thing that we always kind of look to is pens as the cheapest thing we get. But 50 to 80% thought that was okay.
Yeah.
And they felt that anything that would benefit the patient more directly, 80 to 95%, that was okay.
Yeah. Well, you can see the highest numbers are anything that benefits the patient. Like the samples.
Yeah. And I think that's probably reasonable. Again, that goes back to where we started.
Yeah.
The difference in this scenario is that as a clinician, I'm making decisions that affect someone else.
Yeah.
So really, they should be the ones who are getting the benefit of the industry gift, if anyone does. Do you know what I mean?
Like, oh, yeah. No, for sure. And I think, you know, one of the examples that you have on that list is pens. And that's always the, you know, the snarky response you get back from someone. There's no way a pen influences me. And you go, yeah. I know that.
Yeah.
I get that. Do you realize that's not the point that we're trying to get across here? The point is that we don't believe that as a healthcare profession, we should be billboards.
Yeah, that's the thing. There was a great study that looked at, asked residents, this was residents on service with their lab coat and, you know, the pockets filled. And they asked residents, would you wear a label of a drug industry, of a drug company? And they, of course, 80 something percent said no way. Then they asked them to empty their pockets. And I think the average resident, and I'm guessing at this because it's so long ago now, the average resident carried something like 11 pieces of paper. had a drug company label on it. So,
and I've even heard it. So I've even heard a person say, but I remember being at a session. I won't even tell you what the session was, but I was bringing up this saying that, you know, you shouldn't be a billboard. And they said, well, you're wearing Lee jeans and you've got a logo on your jeans.
Yeah, that's the difference, right? That you chose to wear those jeans and you are the one that, you know, paid for them and all of that.
And I'm not selling jeans.
It's a big, people don't. The one that I thought was interesting on this list, James, you'll notice that like dinners, I think we might've mentioned it about a third of people think that that's appropriate versus about half that think it's not. Getting a coffee maker, it was about 40% both ways thought it was either okay or not okay.
But,
you know, it's just interesting. Like, and other studies I've seen done, people have less trust for politicians. They don't think politicians should take any money.
Ever.
But in physicians, they're a little more lenient on certain areas.
Well, because I think in general, if you look at the, you know, pharmacists and nurses and doctors and blah 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 are more trusted than politicians.
So
that's, you know, all of that comes into place. And so, you know, so one of the and by the way, this applies to every healthcare profession. I do sessions with nurse practitioners, with people who are training to be nurse practitioners, and it's exactly the same way. They are being impacted, and there's anybody who prescribes, people are going to try and influence you.
Yes, absolutely.
You know? Yeah. And so, you know, and almost all of them have been to, you know, lunches and dinners, and it kind of goes back to the thing where, you know, if I could get their attention for $10 an hour, I think that's pretty good. I that's a very useful, a very small amount of money to get them to do that. And then people say, but you know, there's so many, I think I need to go there to get, I need to find out what's being said. I need to know about the new medications. And some of the criteria that I use, the arguments is, well, I don't know if you know this, but less than 5% of new medications provide an advantage over what we already have. So assuming that you are going there for an education of a new thing, you probably wouldn't have used it anyway. So that's one thing. And then if you're going to spend an hour having lunch, why not, you know, read a Cochrane review? Or even just do a Google search and look for a systematic review or meta-analysis, or try to identify groups that that you trust to provide you with the latest information, whether it be us, if you do, I don't know, if you're listening to us, I guess you hopefully do. And that, by the way, that was shameless self-promotion. Like I said, find groups that are putting together this information and take your hour and spend it looking at that. And I think you'll actually get better education if that's when we're talking about education and physician stuff.
Yeah, for sure. Like academic detailing is obviously going to come in less biases than industry influence. Like, and this was, you know, our review of the evidence today is it's just to remind people that the evidence, it's kind of like a lot of things. It's not really changing. Industry is not. You know, it's not a single visit with a rep is not going to make someone completely switch their prescribing one way or the other. And then, you know, it might for one person, but the average will not. It's going to change, but the changes are smaller than we might think. And then over time, as I've influenced more, the best evidence is as I have more and more contact and more gifts, I get more and more influence.
That
these things, I know they're self-evident, but it's just, we thought it was important to remind our listeners again that this is out there, and the kind of degree to an effect, of the effect rather, that happens with these. And James kind of said, you know, the pen is, it's not influencing. Yeah, a single pen is likely not, but it's the seed that's planted.
Yeah, and it's also the principle, because, you know, I'm pretty sure, I mean, a company could take me on a very nice trip, and I've done this enough. I know enough about things that is it possible I could be influenced a bit? Yeah, for sure. Am I going to be influenced a ton? No, I don't think I am, because
it all depends on how good the trip is.
It doesn't, Mike. But the reason I don't do it is sort of on principle, and I don't know if that's, it doesn't make me a principled person, but that's the reason I don't do it any longer. Even if I have the ability to not be influenced, I just don't think it's the thing that we should be doing. And so that's the tricky part about it, right?
Yeah, I think the assumption that you might not be influenced is a false one, because even if we accept that. Even if it's possible you're not influenced, you don't know that.
Oh, no. And when I said, that's why I said, I don't think I would be influenced as much as the typical person. Now, I may be just contributing to the exact study that you just talked about earlier.
Yeah, you are.
But this is something that both you and I have done for almost, you know, decades for sure. And, you know, one of the things I used to do as an example is, I always, when I did see drug reps many years ago, was to say, if I'm going to meet with you, could you ahead of time send me your two best RCTs that show your drug is better? And that way I'm actually armed with some information. They often didn't have two. So that's, you know.
The thing that I would do is, you had choices, right? You could not see industry at all, or you could see them. And I chose, when I was working by myself, I didn't. And then when I was teaching, I decided to start to see them because I thought that to make the environment industry free was a bit of a false thing. And we couldn't have the conversation as well without seeing some industry. So what I would do is we would meet with industry, and I didn't get many because I was kind of one of these low prescribers, and they look at your data and know that I wasn't prescribing much. So there wasn't much point in coming to see me. And they also saw that I was cheap. Yeah. So they just knew that I wasn't worth the effort, but some would still come. And then what we would do is we'd have the meeting, and I would not be that pushy about things. I would ask some things, but let it drop quite quickly. Mm-hmm. And then after the rep left, I would ask the resident to try and think of the three things or more, but three things that was done in the session that was done to influence us. And we would kind of dissect the sitting posture, the contact that we had, the way we were looked at, the way a gift as simple as a sticky notepad was given and when it was given, and the like just dissecting the marketing aspect of what was done, I thought was so important for learners to kind of understand how every part of that meeting is strategized. It's often talked about how the people are well dressed, they look good, all of that, but to only focus on that, I think is wrong. There are the behaviors that what we talked about right at the beginning, the compliments, all of, your time is so important, Dr. McCormick. I'm so glad you could fit me in.
No, exactly.
That language is telling you how important and how wonderful you are.
Yeah. I agree. I think it's also very important to realize that, you know, because I've known lots of drug reps, and in general, they're very nice people. I mean, that's
for sure.
And to they are not, they are not, they, it's very hard to hire people who will just go out and lie for you. But they're not given all the information. You know what I mean?
Well, they're not evidence experts.
No,
right?
No, exactly.
That's not what they're trained to be. They often have some medical training of some type or healthcare related field of some type, but that's not even obligatory.
No.
But there's something there that they can build off of, right? But it's mainly the skills of interaction with others.
Yeah.
That the industry is after, and rightfully so. It's a sales job.
Yeah, and just so put it in perspective, if any of the people listening had a company, you'd probably do the same thing.
We do it yourself. Today, you'll probably try and sell your conference. I'll try and sell.
We're all
the same. So we just have to guard against. I think what we wanted to do today is there's a lot of talk about the evils of industry, and also we just wanted to give you an update of the evidence so that, and really no surprise, nothing's changed.
No, exactly.
It's all about relationship building and how you do that.
I agree. So anything else on this topic, Mike?
No, that is it. You want to sell?
I think, you know, for this particular podcast, we should definitely not mention that we have a course coming up on May 24th and 25th.
Well, I'm glad you didn't mention how.
I know, because it would be, I think, hypocritical.
Yeah. Thank goodness you didn't mention it.
Yeah. I wouldn't say that it's in a nice city like Vancouver.
Well, thank goodness you didn't. It's getting more painful than.
No, I know. But
okay, it was a good review, I think.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, no, great job as always, Mike. It's always a good update to talk about this, because really things haven't changed much. If anything, it's more subtle, which is more difficult to discern. So it's all good. Anything else, Mike?
Nope, that is it.
Awesome. So thanks as always for listening.
Talk to you later.